The Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. One of the hot new ideas in education is something called the flipped classroom. Students watch video lectures and instructions at home on their computers and then do their traditional homework like math problems and reading assignments at school. It's being tried in classrooms with the hopes of engaging students with their work in more compelling ways and increasing student achievement. While it may be too soon to tell whether flipped classrooms are more than a passing fad, the anecdotal response has been quite positive. Flipping a classroom, though, does pose some interesting instructional challenges, our topic for today's Radio Times, and we have two guests. Joining us from the studios of Harvard University is Justin Reich. He's the Richard L. Menschel HarvardX Research Fellow and a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. He's also a lecturer at MIT and co-founder of EdTech Teacher. And Justin Reich, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us and joining us by telephone is Richard Halverson. He's a professor in educational leadership and policy analysis in the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, co-author of a book called Rethinking Education in the Age of Technology, The Digital Revolution and Schooling in America. And Rich Halverson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
Justin, let me begin with you. Where did this idea of flipped classrooms come from? What's the genesis or the root of this idea?
Well, I think there are a lot of different peoples who have been exploring different kinds of practices as new technologies have emerged. In some disciplines, you might say that the practice of flipping the classroom is as old as teaching itself, that we used to send students home to view materials and so forth, and then come in and have discussions around it and work with the problems. Two of the biggest popularizers recently are a couple of science teachers named John Bergman and Aaron Sams, who are chemistry instructors, who are actually particularly frustrated with the fact that many of their students in a rural environment missed class a lot for one reason or another, and they got sort of tired in the afternoons of reteaching topics over and over again. So they started recording themselves giving their direct instruction, giving their lectures. They found that having those resources meant they could start thinking a little bit differently about how they use time in their classroom, that they could start having students watch the direct instruction before they came to class, and then they could do problems and do other kinds of work inside class. There are lots of other people who have stumbled on those ideas around the same time, but those are two people in K-12 who are well known for it.
Yeah, Rich, let me toss it to you. And how much do you think this is technology-driven?
I think a lot of it is driven by the availability, the ready availability of video, both for production, for teachers to be able to make their own videos, and also the fact that YouTube exists and teachers and classrooms can access a whole world of videos from other instructors across the world. Maybe even 10 years ago, video production was a much more complex and expensive process than it is now, and so the availability of all sorts of different people who are presenting information makes the flip classroom much more feasible.
And how much you think this is driven by the fact that people just hate homework? I hated homework as a kid. I hated my son's homework when he was a kid. What do you think about that, Rich?
Well, I think that one of the interesting things here is like the transformation of what homework is. So the idea behind homework is you want to be able to give feedback to your students so you can understand how they're understanding the concepts. But when you send homework home with students and you spend your class time giving them information, the feedback loop is broken and you get minimal feedback for homework. And what a flipped classroom does ideally is allow the information presentation to be done at home and then the actual working with students so that you can understand how they're grasping the concepts is the main topic of the class. So it really links back homework and feedback again into being a much more productive learning environment.
What do you think about homework, Justin?
So homework is certainly a controversial topic, and the research literature on it is somewhat mixed. I think there's generally a consensus that some homework seems to lead to student outcomes, better student outcomes, especially as kids get older. But there's no doubt that it's a really controversial topic in a lot of families. I think the most important question with homework is what are the kinds of tasks that we're asking students to do. I think there are a lot of worksheets that go home with kids that have kids practice things and aren't particularly really valuable or routines that are easily solved with Google or other kinds of things now. So the key question with homework is, are we asking kids to do things that's worthy of their time if we're asking them to use their time outside of class?
Well, let me pick up on this part of the flipped classroom, which is that the teacher either makes videos that the children watch at home on their computer or perhaps even use some of the videos that are available online. But I'll toss this first to you, Justin, and then to you, Rich. But I can imagine if you're a mediocre teacher, you're probably going to make a mediocre video for a student to watch at night. How does that improve the learning process?
Sure. Well, I would say that if students are in an environment where they're not getting great instruction, just shifting around the time of that instruction, you're absolutely right, is probably not going to lead to some huge learning gains. But I think the way to think about it maybe is this, and math class is a good kind of canonical example. Mm-hmm. So a lot of what happens in math classrooms today is that a teacher in classroom gets up in front of the classroom and gives some kind of direct instruction, usually the explanation of how to use an algorithm in math class. And then there's a little bit of the rest of class to start on homework, and then kids go home and they start working through those problems. If you ask most math teachers what's the hardest part of that, listening to someone explain how to do something or actually trying to work it out yourself, they would say, well, it's actually trying to work it out yourself. Well, mm-hmm. if the hardest part is working it out yourself, why not have students do that more difficult part in the classroom where they have peers and mentors to support them? So the utility of the flip in that kind of circumstance is that kids can go home and do what is nominally the easier part, the listening to direct instruction. If they get stuck on things, they can listen to it to a couple times and so forth. And then when they're doing the really hard part of applying what they've just learned, they can do that application work inside a classroom where there are peers and teachers and other folks around to help support them through that.
Well, Rich, and I'm nothing against watching videos, but there is something kind of passive about that. And if the idea is that you get the instruction at home, if the instruction isn't compelling or engaging or involving, are students going to learn?
I think that's one of the challenges that the flipped classroom is intended to address, is that a lot of the time information presentation is a passive activity. Mm-hmm. And when you advocate for flipped classrooms, you think that information presentation techniques are sort of interchangeable, so that a good lecture where the teacher is responsive to how students are understanding is just as good as a video. But I think Justin's point is really well taken, that the key to the flipped classroom is that it offloads the more passive part of learning to a time when kids are alone and can do it on their own pace, and it really focuses the classroom time on the hard part, which is the practicing the ideas until you understand them and then providing the instructor with evidence that you're actually getting the concept. I have a feeling what's going to happen is many young people are either going to skip the lectures entirely and go right to the practice, which is sort of like bring the Dewey inversion of education of learning by doing alive,
right.
Or else, I think, and this is something that we're starting to see in high schools and in undergraduate education, students will just find their own lectures. You know, you can look at your teacher's lecture, but if you go to Khan Academy or Brightstorm or just really a number of sites on YouTube, you can find all sorts of alternative representations of the content that can deepen your understanding of the problem-solving activities that will take place in class the next day.
But what about the kids? And you know, there are lots of kids that don't do their homework. So if the classwork is the homework, does if you flip the classroom, do you engage those kids in a different kind of way? And perhaps I'll toss that to you, Justin.
So I think one of the things that a lot of teachers are starting to do is once all of their direct instruction is digitized, then they can give some more control and responsibility to students to figure out how these pieces are going to get done. Once you don't have to have everyone in the same place for being part of the lecture at the same time, right. You can say your responsibility is to make it through this much material and demonstrate these kind of competencies by Friday, by 2 weeks, by a month, by the end of the semester, whatever. And my job is to help you navigate that path. But your job is to move on it. If doing homework doesn't work for you because you have a job or some other things going on, then come into class and watch the lectures and do your homework. If you have lots of work in another topic and you're racing ahead in this one, then when you finish all the competencies you need to demonstrate in this period of time, do something else. Mm. So there's something that's kind of exciting about letting people maneuver on their own pace. It also gives students some choice to say, you know, we're in a topic right now that I can probably work out if I just look at the next set of problems that you give me, so I'm not going to watch the lecture. I don't need it to be able to figure this out on my own. Or as Rich talks about, I'm going to use a variety of different resources to solve these problems. So in some of the best circumstances you could imagine, you could be using all these digital assets to let students navigate their pathways through this material on their own individual pace a little bit more so.
So what is a class, if it's a flipped classroom, then what does the classroom generally look like? Does it look that dramatically different from a traditional classroom? Can I toss it back to you, Justin, and then to you, Rich?
Yeah. So John Bergman and Aaron Sams wrote a book about flipped classrooms, and I love the subtitle of their book, which is Reaching Every Student, Every Class, Every Day. So one of the features of their classroom is because all of the direct instruction time has been offloaded, a huge part of what they can do in every classroom every day is make sure they connect with every single student about where they are. I don't know how many classrooms there are in this country where a teacher can say, yep, I touch base personally with every single student in my classroom. So I think in a lot of these environments, especially the ones that are having the most success with this, when you go in there, you would see students either individually or in groups working on different kinds of things at their own pace. You might find some students who are watching the videos. You might find some students who are working on problems. You might find a teacher had pulled out a group of students that needs some additional support and is, you know, taking a quarter of the class for some additional remediation over a topic or to help them get ahead on something that they're interested in. I think it would look a lot more chaotic than you might see a traditional classroom where everyone's kind of marching through problem six at the same time and then problem eight. But I think the exciting piece about it, for me especially, is that capacity for teachers to really make the time to connect with all of their students to find out where they are and how they can help them move forward.
And Rich, do teachers need instruction on how to manage a very different kind of classroom?
Oh yeah, I think so. I mean, we've been talking in schools of education for a long time about teachers as facilitators, and I think the flipped classroom really brings that about. I mean, the flipped classrooms are louder, and they look more like a place where people are working. You know, a valued teacher skill for a long time, probably forever, is presentation skills. How do you get a message across to an audience that is not really participating verbally? They're listening to you. But like in a flipped classroom, the emphasis shifts over to orchestration. How do you make sure that all the kids are engaged in doing their work? And then how do you check in on them to check for their understanding? And so the teacher is much more of a facilitator of student work, and the instruction is much more dialogue-based rather than monologue-based. So I think it presses teachers. I mean, one of the things that we find, like in math education, is that having a teacher risk their understanding with student questions on a day-to-day basis requires a much deeper understanding of the concepts. It's not enough to simply present the concepts the way they're given in the textbook, because student misunderstandings aren't described in the textbook. So you have to be on your toes, because you know when the basis of your instruction is how students are understanding the ideas, you have to be able to sort of grapple with that misunderstanding or that the way that they're doing their work and bring it back to the path that you want them to be on.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about something called the flipped classroom. The voice you just heard is Richard Halverson. Also with us, Justin Reich. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Glenn Mead, an independent investment and wealth management firm for families, family offices, and endowments and foundations seeking thoughtful advice generation after generation. Details are available from Chip Wilson at 215-419-6100.
Phoebe Wincote supports WHYY. Phoebe Wincote, a community of Phoebe Ministries, provides independent living apartments just minutes from Philadelphia. Phoebe Wincote offers maintenance-free living with close proximity to cultural and education opportunities. Short-term rehab and personal care are also provided, enabling you to age in place as independently as possible. Information can be found at phoebe.org/wincote or to arrange a personal tour, 215-461-2102.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, author Joseph Finder knows about conspiracies, but he says a newly reissued book makes it clear Oswald acted alone.
So as much as we want to believe that, yeah, things happen for a reason, you can't read Marina and Lee and think that it was part of any kind of conspiracy.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY. supporting WHYY, The Economist, covering news and ideas that interconnect the world to give readers a worldview. On newsstands, in bookstores, at economist.com, or on smartphones and tablets.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about flipped classrooms, the idea of flipping homework and traditional classwork so the students watch a lecture at home on their computers and then do their homework in school. And again, our guests are Richard Halverson, professor in educational leadership and policy analysis in the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, co-author of a book called Rethinking Education in the Age of Technology. Justin Reich is a fellow, actually, at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, a lecturer at MIT and co-founder of EdTech Teacher. And the phones have exploded at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Justin, do you think there's certain subjects that lend themselves to the flipped classroom?
Yes, I think the subjects where direct instruction is a big part of what happens already inside the classroom are the subjects which are sort of most ripe for thinking about how you move things around. So a great example is literature. What you do typically in a literature classroom is you send students home with a book. They read a couple of chapters of the book. They work out some things on their own. And then they come into the classroom where they do the difficult work of making sense of the text, making meaning of the text, wrestling with one another to understand things, pushing their ideas, pushing their understandings. You know, for me, a helpful question to ask is how do we set up learning environments so students do the most cognitively difficult work in the place where they have the most peer and mentor support? Historically, English classrooms have been pretty good at having things set up that way. You read alone at home, and that's kind of the easier part, and then you make meaning of stuff together for a variety of reasons, science classes, math classes, other classrooms, where the easier part happens in the classroom, and then you're wrestling with these really hard problems at home. Those are the ones that are ripe for thinking about shifting time and instruction.
And how about, Rich, do you think this can apply to elementary school, junior high school, high school?
Yeah, I think that it's sort of, I think of flipped classrooms as sort of a gateway drug to more sophisticated uses of technology. And so if teachers start to think about offloading some of the presentation content of their class to the virtual world, then it's not that far of a jump before they start allowing students to do online collaboration on projects and to move towards more project-based, making-based curriculum. And those kinds of ideas can be done anywhere, right? So as soon as you have a learning management system that allows students to participate in groups and look at content online, they can look at lectures, but they can also look at each other's work. They can also look at like online making environments, and it really sort of opens the door across the K-12 spectrum for teachers to start establishing what I call more distributed learning environments that are, you know, part technology, part classroom, part student, and part teacher.
But the idea is that in school you're working on projects, you have activities, you're not sitting as someone lectures and you're taking notes, Rich.
Yeah, I think the old and the most traditional version of education is narrative and storytelling, where the older folks have something that the younger folks need to be able to understand and repeat. And I think in a more digital world where students have access to a lot of the knowledge, that teachers and schools don't have a monopoly on the information anymore, knowing how to use that information and how to make stuff, how to pursue your own interests with the information is really the critical skill. And I think flipped classrooms sort of give a legitimate way for teachers to open the door to allow digital content into the classroom and to sort of work with their students towards that more distributed learning environment.
And Justin, what do we do about the digital divide, the fact that poor kids in this country, you know, don't have the same kind of access to technology that more middle class and upper middle class kids have?
That's an incredibly important question. There are a couple of ways to think about it. One is that I think instructors can design learning environments that create broader access for students with different kinds of challenges getting access to technology. So when John and Aaron started recording their lectures, they made DVDs of them. They burned DVDs and they gave them to students who they thought maybe wouldn't have access. I think there are a few other strategies of making sure that there's more time open at the beginning of the day in schools, more time open at the end of schools. Forsyth Smith County, Georgia, has a Bring Your Own Device program that they're working on, and they've started opening up conversations with the McDonald's in Forsyth County, which all have free Wi-Fi available, trying to make sure that students who have difficulty with access to the internet at home know about some of these resources. And maybe there are some questions we'd have about schools sending kids to McDonald's, but at least in terms of getting free Wi-Fi access, that's probably in the right direction. I think the other thing which is absolutely critical is if you talk to the educators in this country who are doing the most innovative work with technology, with students in some of the most difficult circumstances, most difficult neighborhoods, they will tell you they're far less concerned about within school inequalities than they are with between school inequalities. So these are teachers who are not going to say, well, two of my kids don't have access, so therefore we're not going to do anything. If you talk to those teachers, they'll say, look, these kids in the suburbs are having these kind of learning opportunities, and it's harder for my students, but I still have to make it possible for them, and I still have to challenge them to make it possible for themselves to be able to do that. So I think the real inequality to focus on is between schools rather than within classrooms.
Well, but Rich, picking up on that, I mean, then we need to figure out how to get computers and laptops, and I mean, people have cell phones largely, but we have to figure out how to bridge this digital divide.
I think that's the right question. I think the digital divide is a funny thing, because when you think about mobile phones and game consoles, if you include those two devices into the equation, then the digital divide is not nearly as severe as sort of the laptop divide. And so it's most people in the U.S. have access to online content, either at home or at a library or at places like McDonald's. The question is it ready access that can lead to learning? So, like, when you think about the way you do your work in a learning environment, chances are you're connected to a computer, it's online, and if you have an interest that you want to satisfy, it's right there. And the biggest challenge, I think, of the digital divide is the ready availability of online access. It's, you know, if you have to get in a car and drive to get it, that makes it much more difficult to follow up your interest and follow up with a question that you may have and interact online.
Just, I do want to get to some of our callers, but do you see this as a trend that's going to revolutionize education or a tool that some teachers, some classrooms, some schools can use to rethink this relationship between homework and classwork?
I think
let me say one.
Yeah, go ahead, Justin, and then Rich, I'll toss it to you. Go ahead, Justin.
Sorry about that. I just want to say one more thing about the digital divide because it's timely. So the FCC has a program called E-Rate, which provides quite a bit of funding for schools across the country to be able to upgrade their broadband and laptops and other kinds of resources and so forth. And actually, they have a comment period, which is open until tomorrow, is extended because of the sequester, where schools around the country can talk, can send messages to the FCC talking about the circumstances they have in their school. So it's a real opportunity for school leaders to do some public advocacy. There's a website, 99in5.org, 99in5.org, where it provides an opportunity for you to communicate with the FCC about providing some more federal resources to be able to address some of these issues. So I wanted to say that while we were still on that topic.
Sure, go ahead.
Sorry.
And I forget my question. Do you remember it or Justin?
Transformation.
Okay, transfer. Yeah. There we go. Thank you very much for being my brain. Yeah, go ahead, Justin.
Oh, sure. So I think Rich really had a wonderful way of saying this, that these kinds of practices are gateway drugs. Another way that metaphor that I like to use, which is a little bit less narcotic, is to think about these practices as a kind of Trojan mouse. We want to pack inside technologies all kinds of different ideas. So what I love about the flipped classroom is it's really a question about how do we most effectively use the very precious time that we have with our students, which is a question that can include technology, but is much broader than technology at the same time. By what the flip classroom does is it gives teachers a new tool, which, as Rich said, they really have relatively easy access to, creating video, distributing video. These are much easier to do now than they were 10 years ago, 5 years ago. And by giving teachers that tool, it opens up a series of questions and conversations. If we pursue these questions and conversations in rich ways, I think we can find some really interesting outcomes and interesting pathways. I don't think that we should expect that if this conversation ends with we recorded ourselves lecturing and kids watched them before beforehand and they, you know, worked on some problems in class.
Right.
I think if that's the limits of these conversations, then we shouldn't expect much more than some pretty trivial outcomes. But I think this is a great conversation to get people started having to think about how do new technologies let us rethink some really well-established and hard-to-change practices in schools.
Yeah, go ahead, Rich, and then we will get to our callers.
Yeah, I think the big question for me is how is technology changing learning in our world? And it's pretty clear that most of the internet and new media tools that we have around us, video games, Google, Twitter, social networks, these are all learning technologies. They're basically information technologies that we can use to solve problems and get experiences that we want. They're interest-based. And the thing that has frustrated me during the course of my research career is how far schools are behind in embracing the kinds of learning technologies that everybody, every day, uses for their ordinary lives. Schools have been really committed to, at least in the past 10 or 15 years, to a much more standards-driven, back-to-basics approach where all students have to learn all the things that the school cares about in order to succeed, rather than the things that the students are interested in. Hmm. And what that's led to is schools adopting much more assessment-based technologies than learner-based technologies. And so this idea of flipping the classroom, where you put the learner in charge of accessing information and making sense of it, and then demonstrating their understanding in a classroom setting, seems to me a really nice move in the right direction to help schools catch up with the rest of the world with the power of information technologies to further their own interests.
We are talking about the flipped classroom, and that's Richard Halverson, again, a professor in educational leadership and policy analysis in the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, co-author of a book called Rethinking Education in the Age of Technology. Justin Reich also with us. He's a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, a lecturer at MIT, co-founder of EdTech Teacher. Well, let's see what our listeners have to say. 1-888-477-9499. You can send us a tweet. We're checking out things on Facebook, and you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We have Melina from Bluebell, Pennsylvania. Melina, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm so excited to hear this because it makes so much sense to me, and I love the vision. I went to a non-traditional alternative school in Pennsylvania, called Project Learn, which mm-hmm. is still in existence.
Sure.
And my kids are in the suburbs, and they go to traditional school. And we've had homework struggles with my son for almost his entire career at school. He's now in high
pain.
School.
Yep.
And I would love to learn how to bring this to my school district.
Well, Melina, let me toss that to you, Richard.
I think I'm going to defer to Justin on this because this is really the work that he does. So, Justin, go ahead and take a shot at that.
Yeah, go ahead, Justin.
Sure. So, I think one way to get started is to try to find in any school community, there's a group of teachers who are willing to experiment, who are willing to be on the leading edge, and trying to connect those folks with other people who've done that. The flipped classroom, the community of teachers who are engaging in flipped classroom, are one of the most social, inviting, collaborative, supportive group of teachers that you can find connected online. They have regular Twitter chats on Twitter under the hashtag flipped class. Mm-hmm. There are a number of conferences that they run that they pull together, which are usually really inexpensive. They have Open Classroom Day, where they all as a community pick a day that they'll open their classrooms and let people come in and see what's happening there. There are certainly organizations that exist to be able to provide some support for faculty who feel like they need some additional help. You know, the EdTech Teacher, the professional consultancy that I started, we do work with educators to help them understand better how to use some of these practices to give them both a little bit of the technical skills and then also to provide them with some additional support. So I think there are some organizations out there that can provide some consulting to get people started, but I also think there are a lot of resources out there for people to get started. A great resource is John Bergman and Aaron Sam's book that's published by ISTE, the International Society of Technology on Education, called The Flipped Classroom.
You do, though, need research. I mean, it seems that here in Philadelphia, you know, dealing with serious financial problems and a whole host of other problems, problems as well. In order to try something, it seems to me, Rich, you do need some research. And I'm looking at this very preliminary, but nonetheless, some research at the Harvey Mudd College looked at flipped classrooms, compared STEM classes, one flipped, one traditional. They didn't find much difference in the results, I guess, in the results of learning. I realize this is kind of early on, but don't you need some kind of producible or reproducible research in order to make a case for something like a flipped classroom?
Well, research is sort of a flexible term in the time when innovation is just starting to take shape. The kinds of research that tests whether an intervention has results at scale is typically characteristic of more mature interventions that have they're more coherent. Like if there was a flipped classroom curriculum that you could implement across a school that has been tested in a lot of places, that's the kind of thing that leads to either leads or doesn't lead to reproducible results. The flipped classroom to me is more at the level of technique. Mm-hmm. It's like a part of the educator's toolkit, so that a teacher can experiment with the ways in which they spend their time in the classroom by taking some of that information presentation and putting it online. Once that becomes part of a teacher's repertoire, then I think we could start to see whether or not that you have significant gains in standardized tests. But then the other part that's really interesting to me is that standardized tests only measure part of the things that we need to teach our kids, like the ability to interact online and make arguments and use internet resources for information search. That stuff doesn't show up at all in our standardized tests, and it's at least debatable whether those skills that are really the working skills, the vocational skills, and the life skills for the 21st century aren't the things we ought to be teaching our kids.
Justin, I think we've done a lot of shows about education on Radio Times, and I think in many ways teachers feel they're in a straitjacket. I mean, they have to teach the test. They have all these pressures and responsibilities, and this all sounds really engaging and interesting and a challenge, but I know so many teachers feel so overwhelmed.
Every great teacher in America right now is subversive. Every great teacher in America right now is looking at all those things and saying, how do I evaluate which of these standards do I really have to meet because they're going to serve my students for the rest of their life? Mm-hmm. What are the kinds of things that we have to get them through sort of gatekeeper checkpoints and things like that? And what do I have to look at and say, this isn't really in the best interests of young people? I do think that the flipped classroom doesn't necessarily its utility doesn't necessarily depend upon whether you're in an environment really trapped by places where we have over concerns about standardized test scores and things like that. I mean, you can use the flipped classroom to help make progress towards all different kinds of strategies. My hope in working with teachers on some of these kinds of things is that by having some more control over time, by having some more effective uses of where people are doing work in the classroom, we might be able to help teachers find some breathing room and find some places for creativity and places for student ownership that Rich talked about. I think it could be a really invigorating part of people's practice to be able to explore some of these ideas.
Indeed. Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation and our callers. That's Justin Reich, co-founder of EdTech Teacher. He's also a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Richard Halverson with us as well. He's with the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, a co-author of a book called Rethinking Education in the Age of Technology. We're talking specifically about flipping the classroom, using homework in the class and classwork at home. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Friends Select, the Center City Quaker School, supports WHYY. Friends Select combines academics with real-world exploration in the classroom, in Philadelphia, and beyond. By asking questions and inviting students to make independent discoveries, Friends Select teachers do more than instruct. They strive to spark lasting fascination. An open house is Monday, November 11th. Full details at friends-select.org. Friends Select, fascination, forever bright.
Identity and sexuality in India.
When we started working, I asked the girls a question, who are you? And the girls answered, I am nobody.
The nobodies of India are often young girls taught to think of themselves as having no value. One Woman of India confronts the mindset of women and the problem of sexual assault next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. This is music that captures the exuberance, the promise of a great nation. The Philadelphia Orchestra, under Manfred Honeck, performs Dvorak's New World Symphony, and Christian Tetzlaff plays Mozart's Turkish Violin Concerto. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or at philorc.org today. November 14th, 15th, and 16th at the Kimmel Center, Dvorak's New World Symphony with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and we're talking about the flipped classroom, and it goes something like this. Teachers make or use video lectures on academic subjects, which the students then watch at home on their computers. And the things we associate with homework, things like math problems and writing assignments, are done in the classroom. Again, we are talking with Richard Halverson and Justin Reich and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We had someone post something on our Facebook page. How do you make people accountable for the work done at home? And Justin, perhaps I'll toss that back to you. Is that an issue?
Sure. Homework accountability is always an issue, and there are no silver bullets to resolving it. Teachers do all kinds of creative things. They embed questions inside the videos, and then they have little homework forms that are associated with it. So I might create like a little Google survey or something like that that says, you know, not only something like, you know, what was the answer to the secret question, or, you know, what did I say at this time or something like that. But you can also add things like, at what minute in the video did you become confused? At what minute in the video did you stop understanding? And then you can aggregate those, you know, timestamps and try to figure out what kids are understanding and what they're not. I think the most important thing, too, is making sure that when kids arrive at class, they're held accountable for what they're expected to do in the rest of their time. So one strategy that a lot of teachers use is to put students in collaborative groups and have people have different responsibilities in those collaborative groups that depends on everyone coming to class prepared. And that's another strategy for being held accountable. A third strategy is to say it doesn't matter when students get the work done. They have some sort of final deadline. And if they want to watch the videos in class and then try to get their work done, and if that works for them, that's great. And we'll support students who try that and are not successful. So there are a couple different strategies there.
Rich, we had a tweet, someone wondering whether flipped classrooms let students control the flow of information.
Yes and no. I think the reason why flipped classrooms are catching on quickly is because they're not that different than the way that teachers currently do their work, mm-hmm. right? So that there's still a lesson, there's still prescribed content, and there's still problems that teachers want students to work on. You can have some self-paced and differentiated work, but in a more I don't even know if I can say this yet. A more traditional flipped classroom model. it's the same kind of pace. It's just that the information work is sort of redistributed, and so it seems like this student understanding is probably going to take the lead in the classroom, because if students don't get the concepts, the teachers will understand that and be able to address it because they have more time to work with students. But I'm not so sure this leads to the sort of much like more interest-based, self-directed learning yet. I mean, I think it's probably a start towards that.
But it sounds, Justin, like it's trusting students that they want to learn, they will learn, and perhaps they'll do it at their own pace, but that they can complete their work, their assignments.
Well, and you're in the classroom with them. I mean, that's the thing about this. Like, the homework is being done while you're there. Right, and so it's not surprising to me that flipped classroom teachers are reporting higher rates of homework completion and higher test scores, because, you know, in academia and classrooms like everywhere else, if you do the work, you have a much better chance of understanding the concepts. And when you're doing the work right with your teacher and right with your peers, there's a much better chance you're going to get it done rather than, you know, playing another round of, you know, Call of Duty with your friends at home, right?
I know exactly what you're talking about. Justin, do you want to weigh in on that? Then we'll get back to our callers.
I think Rich said it perfectly.
Okay, perfect. Let me see what Jim from, did we do Jim? No, Jim from South Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Jim, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome.
One thing I haven't heard as part of the discussion. I think it's very important. I'm a teacher myself, and that would be who owns this content. I think the teachers are creating these videos and sending them out, and then I could foresee a conflict where the teacher may leave the school district and the school district may say, well, hold on, you can't take those videos with you. We own that. Or even more severe, I think, is the school district takes those videos and starts selling them to other school districts for them to use without the teacher's permission. So I was wondering if what your guests thought about that and if they've seen problems arise at schools around the school around that issue.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the call, Jim, from a teacher. Justin, can you respond to that?
So I would say those issues are certainly more controversial and tense in higher education settings where professors have traditionally had an income stream from producing curriculum materials, much more so than typical K-12 teachers. But there certainly are some cases out there of K-12 schools that have started declaring that they, started billing in contracts that they have ownership rights of teacher materials and things like that. My personal view is that the most productive possible way forward is if the people who are creating these materials make a commitment to make them openly licensed using Creative Commons licenses, that schools make a commitment that the materials that they support their teachers in creating are licensed under Creative Commons. I mean, most of this work in most circumstances, there are certainly some private schools out there, but a lot of this work is being paid for by public taxpayers. And the benefits of the kinds of instructional innovations that we have should, if they're paid for by the public, should be made broadly accessible to the public. So I think really trying to have a movement of teachers who create, and many people involved in the flipped classroom are already really wonderful about doing this, about making the materials that they create openly licensed using Creative Commons licenses that allow these works to be shared and redistributed and remixed in as many different ways as possible.
Let me get Susan from Bucks County to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Susan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. My son is currently in a flipped classroom for his math course, and math can be dry, so he finds the lecture rather dry, and when he goes into the classroom the next day, there may be one or two students that has gotten the concept, and they tend to teach the class. The kids gravitate to the one or two students that grasp it, and then the students tend to gravitate to them, and they end up teaching the class.
Does that bother you, or does it bother your son, Susan?
So far, it hasn't been a very popular concept within the class. It seems like a lot of the students are struggling with it. We're open to anything, and I know technology, everything's changing
right
as we speak, but I haven't now, for my son, so far he's keeping his head afloat, but it seems that a lot of students are struggling.
Well, that's interesting. Let me see what Rich, what do you think about that?
So on the one hand, that's really good news, because when you want to build a classroom of the future, you want it to be distributed not only in terms of the different technologies you're using, but also the different expertise of the learners. I mean, we've had schools for a really long time where there's one person who's supposed to know the stuff, and the rest of the people are supposed to try to learn what that person knows. So on that sense, that's, I think, a really exciting development. The other part, though, is the lack of compelling interest of the videos and the degree to which the caller's son doesn't understand the
sure
content the way it's provided. And that feedback's got to get back to the teacher so that the teacher understands that the presentation work that's being done on, of the information isn't getting across to students. This obviously calls for a really different approach to teacher evaluation, where instead of, an administrator or a colleague coming into your room and looking at what's happening in the room, you have to take a much more holistic view of the way the classroom is being orchestrated, including the online materials, to help give the teacher a sense of what's effective in reaching her students and what's not.
Because, Justin, we still need good teachers, right? I feel silly even saying that. But go ahead, Justin.
No, that's absolutely right. One of the things I was going to add, too, on this point of engagement is that in our conversation we've had an assumption that the direct instruction, for instance, that we use in math class, the explanations of how to do an algorithm to solve a problem, are going to be maintained. I think there's a lot of good evidence in mathematics instruction that, in fact, these digitized materials don't have to be explanations of how to do things. They could be really provocative problems. They could be really interesting challenges. If you look at the sort of patterns of practice in really high-performing countries with their mathematics instruction, you'll see that rather than having a situation where a teacher explains how to do something and then says, you know, practice this 40 times, you know, numbers 1 through 31 odd, they say, here's a challenging problem, work on it. Start to see if you can figure out how to do it. If you can't figure out how to do it, let's get together in some groups, and then let's surface some different ideas, and let's make sense of things together. So one of the things that you could imagine is that some of this digitized content doesn't have to be, we don't have to lead with, and here's the explanation of how you do it, now practice. We could lead with, here's some interesting questions and some mm-hmm. compelling challenges. There's a wonderful math teacher and researcher at Stanford named Dan Meyer, who's done some really fabulous work with a concept he calls three-act math, where he tries to get students to explore mathematics stories. Like, he'll take a video of himself shooting a basketball and pause the video when the basketball is at the apex of the parabola, and then students watch it, and somebody, you know, shoots their hand up and says, does this go in? And he goes, right, let's figure that out. There's a wonderful video made by a teacher in New York named Michael Pershan called What If Khan Academy Was Made in Japan, which talks about what would it look like, and you can Google that and it's pretty easy to find, What If Khan Academy Was Made in Japan, right. Where he describes what patterns of practice in classrooms would look like if we started by using digitized instruction to ask students questions rather than to give them the answer.
Let me see what Bryce from Horsham has to say. And Bryce, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I just was listening to this. I've done some teaching off and on over the years at various levels. And one of the things I've noticed is the drop in writing skills, particularly in entry-level college students. I mean, some serious degradation of writing skills. And a lot of that seems to be associated with texting and tweeting and so forth and so on, because they actually write papers as though they're texting someone. Anyway, the point of all this is that what I get a little concerned about is what seems to have happened over the years is a substitution of video for reading. And writing skills, to a large degree, develop from reading well-written stuff. And I'm just curious, sure. And it seems to me like, I think that, by the way, I think the flip classroom in principle is a great idea, but I have a little concern that if you're just watching videos instead of, you know, doing your class prep homework, which involves sitting down and reading a book or something to that effect, is there a risk of further diminishing emphasis on reading and writing?
Fair enough. Bryson, Justin, I'll toss that first to you. Go ahead.
So I think the quality of student writing is a very serious concern. I'm much more likely to peg it on the kinds of writing assessments, especially on standardized tests, that we ask students to do rather than texting or tweeting. I think if there are some potential opportunities here, it's to say let's have students do some of their writing in classrooms where they can get peer and mentor support to help them with that. We also really have to make sure, I think one of the things the caller builds up is that there's certainly plenty of practices that we've developed, you know, in this country over the last few hundred years of public education, where we've figured out some things that work really well, and the things that we think are really effective, we need to make sure that we preserve and maintain. Asking students to think through really challenging questions and issues by having them writing through those problems is incredibly important, and there should be nothing that we do with technology that totally replaces that. Although we do need students who are able to communicate in all kinds of different media. We need them to be able to communicate through images, through audio, through video, through a combination of these kinds of tools, through code, through programming. And that's an enormous challenge that we face in an ever more complicated world of how do we prepare students with all these different skills.
Bryce, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Rich, I'm also wondering about teachers, and I know teachers who spend hours often at night grading homework. Does this if you flip the classroom, does that eliminate those many hours at the kitchen table grading papers?
I don't think so. I think that the preparation time to understand how students are understanding the concepts is probably not any different at all. I'm guessing that the teacher will have a much better insight into the patterns and the way that students are getting or not getting the concepts because he or she is working with those students during the class, during the day. So you can see, we've been taking math examples, you can see when people are trying to do a geometry proof, the three or four mistakes that everybody across the class is making as they're making them.
Right.
Right? So then you can design your lessons because you get a glimpse into the understanding process. The difficulty of grading homework is that you're grading the end product. You don't really understand the process of thinking that kids are going through, but if you're there helping them, You know, the important thing to remember in the flipped classroom idea is that it's not instead of, it's just flipped. Right, so the attention that you give to homework is the same attention you'd ever give to homework, except you can do it in a one-to-one and group basis that's much more meaningful to students.
Let me squeeze one more caller, Tiffany from Ambler, joining us on Radio Times. Tiffany, go ahead, very briefly, if you don't mind.
Sure, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm listening to the description of the flipped classroom, and I've noticed a lot of parallels between what goes on in that classroom and the Montessori philosophy of learning. So I'm just wondering if your guests can comment quickly on whether Montessori philosophy played a role in design of the flipped classroom. Thank you.
You're welcome. Interesting question. Justin, is there a parallel there, do you think?
I think the flipped classroom wasn't made by one person, so it was made by lots of different people who were inspired by lots of different ideas. But I think progressive educational philosophies from Maria Montessori, from Reggio Emilia schools, from John Dewey, all have an influence of trying to ask this question: how can we make sure that students have a learning experience where they're the owners, where they're the co-creators of their learning experience, and we're not just trying to fill their brains mm-hmm. with buckets that we pour out of teachers' brains? So I think if you're seeing some connections there in the best implementation of these kinds of tools, I think those connections are there and thriving.
Because when you watch a little kids, like a 3 or 4 year old, that's exactly what they're doing, right? They're constantly
Absolutely.
Experimenting and doing projects and trying to figure out the world.
It's a fascinating place.
It is, and much to learn. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times, giving us a flavor for what a flipped classroom is. Justin Reich, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And Richard Halverson, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And Rich Halverson, professor in educational leadership and policy analysis in the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin. He's also co-author of Rethinking Education in the Age of Technology. Justin Reich is a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Joined us from the studios of Harvard. He's a lecturer at MIT and co-founder of EdTech Teacher. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. Jessica Crocker, our intern, and Adam Staniszewski is our engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.